By far, most people I know are married. And if God created us to be married, how could it be that singleness is a gift?
Welcome again to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. On today's program, Dr. Jack Crabtree and marriage and family therapist Christine Barber continue their discussion on singleness. Many people experience singleness as a gift from God, but many others long to be married and see their singleness as a kind of curse. They might ask, am I single because I don't trust God enough? Or is it that for some reason, I'm not attractive to others? Where is God in all this? Let's listen now to Jack and Christine.
This is the second program on our series on singleness. Last week we talked about, how should I look at singleness? Is it a curse? And we said emphatically, no, it's not. And we ended by saying, in fact, maybe singleness can be a gift. Jack, in just what way can singleness be a gift?
There are probably two passages we could go into the New Testament that imply that singleness is a gift. One of them is something like Matthew 19. It's after Jesus has talked about divorce, and the disciples say to him, let me read it in 19:10. It says, the disciples said to him, to Jesus, if the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry. But Jesus said to them, not all men can accept this statement, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who are born that way from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who are made eunuchs by men, and there are also eunuchs who made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to accept this, let him accept it. And many people have pointed out that they think that that implies a kind of gift that some people have, that is to say, they are able to accept it. There are other people who are not able to accept it.
We're going to have to back up a minute here, okay. Because what is a eunuch?
Okay. I think he's using a eunuch as, you know, literally, is someone who's been castrated and therefore is incapable of sexual relationship. Eunuchs typically in the ancient world were made servants for the slaves that served the needs of the harem of the king or whoever, and they altered them anatomically so that they wouldn't be messing with the wives of the king.
Wouldn't have sexual relationships with the wives of the king. Is that what you mean by messing?
Yes, that's what I mean.
Okay. You know, so, we have to be really honest here. We had this little side discussion that we took off tape, but I said to Jack, you know, what is being a eunuch? And he wasn't sure exactly what that meant, so we're hedging just a little bit.
Right. But that's irrelevant because
good.
I think in this passage, when he talks about being a eunuch, I think he's really using that as kind of representative of someone who's single, someone who's been made a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. I don't think he really has in view someone who has altered themselves anatomically for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. I think he means someone who's simply not going to participate in the relationship of a marriage relationship and is going to live celibate and single for the rest of their life for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Paul, at the time you see him when he's writing his letters, is a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom of heaven, I think, even though he's not literally a eunuch. So I don't think Jesus is speaking literally here when he uses the term.
He's saying people who are choosing to be single, people who are not married.
Yeah, they're choosing against marriage, exactly. And, you know, he's saying the point that he makes is some were born that way. That is, some, for one reason or another, there's something that makes them not candidates for marriage because of some biological, or I suppose it would even include psychological or emotional reasons. There's just something about the way God created them that marriage is just not going to be a viable option for them. And they were born that way. There are other people who were made that way by men. He may be speaking literally there now. But again, by extension, kings made their slaves eunuchs. But can a parent, for example, so damage a child, their psyche, that again, marriage is not viable for them in the way that they have treated them and the experiences that they've had?
That they just can't enter into a relationship. They don't have perhaps the trust it takes to
exactly.
be in a committed relationship with another person. They're
exactly.
just too hurting.
So they've somehow been victimized in life in such a way that marriage is no longer a real viable option to them. And then other people have just chosen. he says, for the sake of the kingdom of God. And we'll get into that later. The way Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians is that singleness provides a kind of freedom of movement and a kind of freedom to take risks that is not available to someone who's married. It's not as available for someone who's married. And Paul really treasures that freedom that he has. He can serve his Lord in a way that his married counterparts cannot. And that's something for which he's very grateful. And he treasures that. I think that's the kind of thing Jesus is talking about here.
Talking about when he says what?
When he talks about eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven.
So a person has made themselves a eunuch in order to serve God with a level of freedom that someone who's married cannot because of their commitment to their marriage partner.
Exactly, yeah.
What would that look like, Jack?
To be a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom of heaven?
Right.
Well, let me turn to another passage. This is Paul writing in his letter to the 1 Corinthians in chapter 7, starting with about verse 25. He says, "Now concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give an opinion as one who by the mercy of the Lord is trustworthy. I think then that this is good in view of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you should marry, you have not sinned, and if a virgin should marry, she has not sinned. Yet such will have trouble in this life, and I am trying to spare you. But this I say, brethren, the time has been shortened, so that from now on both those who have wives should be as though they had none, and those who weep as though they did not weep, and those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, and those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it, for the form of this world is passing away. But I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. And his interests are divided. And the woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I say for your benefit, not to put a restraint upon you, but to promote what is seemly and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord." What Paul is describing there is that, I don't think it was in the passage I read, but at another point in the passage, he talks about remaining as I am, that he sees himself as being in this position of being able to give undistracted devotion to the Lord, precisely because his attentions are not divided between the service of the Lord and his wife. He's actually speaking out of what I think is a very high view of marriage. And what I mean by that is, he takes marriage seriously enough to know that if you are in a committed marriage relationship, there's a lot of work and a lot of energy, a lot of time, a lot of attention that needs to be given to one's wife or one's husband, as the case may be, in order to do it right, in order to be responsible, in order to do it in the way that's pleasing to the Lord. By contrast, if he's single, now he can devote himself to the Lord. That needs to be understood. What he means by that, I think, is he can give himself fully to whatever his calling is. In his case, being an apostle to the Gentiles, a prophet, a teacher, a missionary, that he can devote himself to the task of spreading the gospel and explaining and articulating the gospel without the distraction of having to provide financially and materially for his wife and children, provide for their safety, provide for their comfort. That's not a responsibility that is on his shoulders. And accordingly, he has that much more freedom and that much more time to devote exclusively to the spreading and articulating of the gospel. And that's the way in which he sees it, as undivided attention.
Jack Crabtree teaches at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College. For years, he has relentlessly pursued truth, for he believes that truth is both knowable and from God. He is also a man dedicated to his family. In fact, you may even have seen him watching his kids score goals at regional soccer tournaments. For Jack, the truth of the gospel is relevant to all of life. His pursuit of understanding God's Word has only deepened his appreciation for God's wonderful mercy. much of the fruit of Jack's studies, are available on tape. You can find out more by asking for the McKenzie Study Center tape catalog. Information will be given at the end of the program on how you can contact McKenzie. Christine Barber is a professional marriage and family therapist. Along with Larry, her husband of 20 years, she works with the Caris Foundation, a nonprofit organization committed to bringing healing and renewal to the lives of Christian leaders. Besides her work in counseling, she's an avid gardener. For her, the beauty of the garden speaks of God's character and his involvement in our lives. She sees God as the author of all creation and the source of our salvation. And she also sees that the truth of the gospel provides the only sufficient foundation for her work as a therapist. Now here again are Jack and Christine.
So Jack, right before the break, you brought us to a passage, I believe it was 1 Corinthians 7, to help us understand what does it really look like to make myself single or a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Your answer was, so I can devote myself, or Paul's answer is, so I can devote myself to the spreading of the gospel without the encumbrance of marriage. You said that he had marriage in a very prestigious place, in the sense that, prestigious, that's probably not the right word, but in a high place, because he saw marriage, when somebody's married, that they really do need to be devoted to the needs and the concerns and the issues of their wife or their husband, and to be very, very concerned and devoted to that, thus giving them less time to be devoted to the gospel.
Or whatever their calling is, yeah.
In Paul's case, it was the spreading of the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be, if your gifting is, whatever your gifting is, you have more of a opportunity to be involved in that.
Yeah, both in terms of more time and I think more freedom. I mean, if you look at Paul's ministry, for example, in 2 Corinthians, he describes all the dangers that he was subjected to by robbers and on shipwreck and sleepless nights and so on, that he was able to take risks knowing that the only thing, the only one he was responsible for was to his Lord, to serve him and to himself. And if he lived, fine. If he died, okay, that's okay too. There's a certain freedom there that comes, that if I know I have responsibility for my wife and my children, then I'm taking a risk on behalf of all of us, not just me. And that's very limiting. I mean, that limits you in a way that being single is not limited.
Another way that there's freedom is the freedom of time.
Yeah.
Very often I see in my life that all my life is not doesn't have many periods at the end of the sentences. I just have a lot of commas, and the commas are filled in by coming home and my children are there, or my husband is there. And there's really very little time to stop, and at least with ease to stop. And as a single person, I have more of an opportunity to claim my own time. I don't have a lot of people, unless I bring them into my life, that are always telling me or always wanting to take up my time. I can, for example, walk into an empty house and not have the question, Mom, what's for dinner? Or, Mom, help me with my homework. There, I can walk into an empty house and I can think about what I'm going to do without people coming at me with their needs right away. Now, that's a real upside. Obviously, I don't want to talk about that in too glowing of terms, because there's definitely a downside, which comes in the form of being very lonely for very many single people, which is something we need to address.
There's two ways of looking at that. Paul is looking at it in only one of those. That time that does not belong to my family, I can either claim that for myself, or I can serve the Lord in that time. And Paul's looking at it in the latter way. Yet he would never take the perspective that my time is ever really my own. It belongs to the Lord.
And in that respect, I'd like to talk about something that comes to mind for me. Lots of people who are single are not using it for the Lord. The reality is many, many single people are using it just feeling very, very, very awful about being single, spending all their time thinking about their loneliness, trying to be involved in relationships, being very encumbered by that desire and feeling very left out of the world, feeling not a part of the community, feeling alone. And so they're not pursuing, they're not using their time to pursue the kingdom of God. They're using their time to bemoan that they're not a part of life.
Yeah, I think that's a tragedy that you see all too often, is that if you take the perspective that my life really can't begin until I get married, and that as a single person I'm just waiting and hoping for the opportunity for my life to begin when I get married, and that in the meantime I'm going to spend all my time either nursing my wounds or finding one pursuit after another to distract me from my sorrows, just in a kind of waiting game for life to begin, then we waste all that opportunity. Because really, I think what Paul would see is you've been given this very, very precious gift for the time being. You can pursue your calling with a vengeance. You can pursue your calling undistracted. So find what God would have you do and serve people. Serve the Lord in whatever way is appropriate in your particular case.
I'm a little afraid of getting off balance here in this respect. Last week we said, if we are single, we will have a sense of deprivation, because really being married is the state that God placed us in. Or it's a natural state. It's something that we really desire with all our heart.
We are created for that.
We're created for that. Okay. And so we're desiring that. It makes all the sense in the world that we would experience the deprivation of not having that, and that would be a hard thing.
Right.
We are not saying today that we pretend as though we don't have what we really need, deny it, pretend like it isn't there. That's not what we're saying at all. On the other hand, we don't go to the other extreme and say we just live bemoaning the fact that we don't have this.
Yeah, it's the difference between suffering and self-pity, I think, is really what we have to keep in view. It's one thing to feel the pain and the emptiness and the deprivation of being single, and then of not being married. But then I can respond to it in one of two ways. I can say, okay, God has not given me what deep down inside I have a desire to have. What am I going to do with that? Am I going to feel sorry for myself because God hasn't given that to me? Or I'm going to accept that from God and pursue the life that He's given me to live, a single life. And what would He want me to do with my singleness? To use my freedom to serve Him. But it doesn't mean that the pain is going to go away. It doesn't mean that the loneliness is going to go away. It doesn't mean that I'm all of a sudden not going to care that need is not met. I may care very, very deeply that I'm single, but I'm not going to let it stop me from making the choices that the Lord would have me make.
I like the distinction that you made, because lots of us say, okay, self-pity means I can't feel the deprivation. And that's kind of their sign. If I'm still feeling sad about the fact that I'm single, then I'm doing something wrong. And that's not what you're saying at all.
Right.
In fact, it's pretty much the opposite of what you're saying. So how this might work itself out in a single person's life, let's look at that for a minute. I might really be working toward pursuing God and His kingdom and using my gifts to do that. At the same time, I might have a best friend that I call and say, you know, tonight I'm by myself and I'm feeling really lonely, and talk about that, and maybe talk about some ideas of what I can do about my loneliness. Maybe have the person come over, and periodically we cry together. We experience the deprivation of life as it really is, and yet we're also saying, I want to go forward with my life in a way that really serves God.
Exactly, yeah.
I'd like to focus on this area of self-pity and suffering again, just to bring it into a little bit more clear focus, because that's just a very difficult distinction to make. And let me see if this is helpful. Perhaps self-pity comes out of a rebelliousness, a heart of rebelliousness. It's saying, I am not willing to be single. I am not willing to be poor. I'm not willing to have a bad marriage. I'm not willing to have bad health. And it's a clenched fist, tight, I'm not going to accept what God has for me under any circumstances, and He's just simply wrong that He gave that to me. Poor me.
Yeah.
Suffering can look like self-pity in the sense that it's very sad. It is looking at something that I don't have that I really want. But it doesn't come out of a rebellious heart. It comes out of a sadness because there's legitimate needs that God made me to have, and they're just not being satisfied. Or there may be needs that maybe they're not things that I was created to be, like rich, but I'm in a rich community where everybody else has money and I don't. Well, Safdie would say, God, you've got to make me rich too. You know, clenched fist, and you've got to do this. A sad person might cry about it, might hurt about it, might recognize what they don't have every day. And yet at the same time, they're saying, okay, God, you gave this to me. I'll struggle with it, but I'm going to keep going forward, looking at, trying to find who you are in the midst of this very difficult circumstance.
Yeah, I think that's well said. My own bouts with self-pity, I liken them to, they're kind of my own adult version of a child who throws a temper tantrum, holds their breath till they go unconscious or bang their head against the wall or something like that. It's basically a kind of self-punishing behavior on the one hand, but I'm punishing myself with someone else in view. Namely, if you're not going to give me what I want, then I'm not going to accept this. I'm not going to be content. I'm not going to allow myself to be happy. I'm going to punish myself here and make myself miserable in hopes that I make you miserable by my misery. I'm not going to let you be happy if you're not going to give me what I want.
So it includes a large sense of self-pity includes a large sense of manipulation.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's at its root. That's what my self-pity is rooted in, is that I'm trying to manipulate God. I'm going to make myself miserable, so miserable that you have to get me what I want to make me happy.
Or it can be focused on another person, my husband or wife, my friend, my parent.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to make myself miserable. I'm going to throw this tantrum so that you'll change in the direction of where I want you to go, so I don't have to experience this suffering. Suffering, on the other hand, is a person who isn't trying to make God or anyone else change, but is willing to face into the suffering. That doesn't mean deny it. That doesn't mean pretend that it's not there. It can't mean that. It means I'm facing into it, and I'm suffering it with it fully.
I'm just appreciating the tragedy of what reality has given me. Yeah,
appreciating is a weird the tragedy.
Word, but yeah, but I'm acknowledging that this hurts.
Yeah.
I'm seeing that it hurts, and I emotionally respond in the appropriate way. It's sorrow.
And as a single person, I'm not just going to acknowledge it once. I'll probably acknowledge it many, 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 many times throughout my life.
Absolutely.
In many different contexts. When I'm 20 years old, I'm going to acknowledge it very differently than when I'm 50 years old. And so recognizing and going through the understanding of what's going on with me, kind of the developmental stages, so to speak, of being a single person and having sorrow in context of those stages is very appropriate and isn't a lack of faith and isn't self-pity.
Right. I think what we've just been talking about is important in the context of this idea that my singleness is a gift, or what sometimes Bible teachers call the gift of celibacy. I think sometimes that's often misconstrued, because they see the gift of celibacy as having this special ability to not feel the deprivation, to not feel the pain, that God has somehow made me into a person who doesn't want to be married, and what a glorious place to be in, to not have to want to be married, given that I'm not. Now, I don't think that's true. That though, on the one hand, I think it is the case that the person with the gift of singleness, the one who makes himself a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom of heaven, for example, has put his desire for marriage in a kind of perspective, is able to forego it to a degree that their life is really manageable as single people. They don't just have this ongoing, enduring longing to be married that they can't stand. And I think that's certainly true.
It isn't their only focus. It isn't the only thing they live for.
Right, right. But on the other hand, I think it's an ever-present sense of need unfulfilled, and ever-present sense of their being deprived of something that other people have. The gift of celibacy, the gift part of it, is not that I am without a desire for marriage. The gift part of it, I think, is this unique opportunity that singleness affords me to have a freedom and time and the luxury of having an undivided, being able to serve the Lord with an undivided attention. That's why it's called a gift, I think.
Wow, I've always thought about it the other way, that there are some people who just, for some whatever reason, have this lacking a sense of really wanting to be married. But you're saying that's not true at all.
Yeah, I don't think so.
In fact, that doesn't really even make any psychological sense to me. It kind of seems silly at this point for me to have thought about that, because we're made for that. And it seems to me the only reason we would not feel the deprivation is because we would somehow pretend like it wasn't there, or convince ourselves over time that it didn't exist. Not that we would be some kind of a different human being that wouldn't experience that. In fact, it seems to me if I don't experience that need at all as a single person, then I might be looking at some hardening that might have gone on in my heart, some unwillingness to suffer, some
right.
unwillingness to see reality, which is a bad spiritual condition.
Right.
But you're saying the gift of celibacy then is the gift of time and a freedom that we have to pursue the kingdom of God, however that might uniquely look in our lives.
Right.
If I was single, it might look like I could counsel a lot more, because that's the area of my gifting. In your life, it might be that you could study and teach the scriptures more.
Yeah, and not be quite as tied to geographical location and to the financial problems of providing for my family and so on. I could live a much more Spartan life, for example. There's all kinds of freedom that would buy me that I just don't have.
So, you're thinking of sending your kid to college? Or do you want to attend yourself? Before making your decision, be sure to ask this question. What is college for? For some, college is the rite of passage from youth to adulthood. For others, it's a stepping stone to a good job. Gutenberg College believes education should be a doorway to a good life. Then you might wisely ask, what is a good life? The Gutenberg College faculty and staff are committed to the conviction that living the good life is rooted in wisdom and character. Admittedly, Gutenberg is not for everyone. But if you are interested in reading and discussing the greatest thinkers, philosophers, poets, and theologians of Western civilization, if you are interested in working personally with your teachers, if you want to open the doorway to a good life, there is not a better education opportunity offered in the Northwest than Gutenberg College. Most members of the Gutenberg faculty also teach at McKenzie Study Center. McKenzie was founded on the belief that a clear understanding of God's Word is more than an intellectual exercise, that the Bible has a radical message for every human being. At McKenzie, you can find classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes, and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday experiences. At the conclusion of today's program, I'll tell you how you can contact McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College. But now, let's get back to Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber.
Jack, another issue that I've heard in regard to singleness is that if I'm single, then I really am kind of spiritually above people who are married. What do you think about that? Is that true?
Yeah, at least in Protestant circles, I don't know that that's a particularly common point of view in our day and age. And to the extent that it is, it would be because they are taking their cues from certain passages in the scripture that they think, that they interpret as saying that. But throughout the history of the church, that's been in a way the predominant view, that that being single is kind of to be extra saintly, to be particularly, especially devoted to God and therefore super spiritual. And that, I think, has been the prevailing view. That there may be other passages, but it's likely that 1 Corinthians 7, a passage we've already mentioned, is the passage that people would go to see biblical support for that, where Paul seems to be kind of expounding the virtues of being single. But I think if we look at that passage carefully, I think what we would see is that Paul is not for a second suggesting that there is anything morally or spiritually deficient about getting married. and that somehow staying single is a morally and spiritually preferable choice to being married. Rather, what he's talking about there is just the are those kinds of advantages to singleness that he'd been talking about. And I would add one more. There is a certain advantage to singleness in that you are ridding your life, you are avoiding one more temptation to worldliness. Much in the same way that a wealthy person is in a dangerous position, because a wealthy person has the option available to them to see their money and their material possessions as the solution to their problems. An impoverished person doesn't even have the option of thinking that because the god mammon just isn't there for them. But the god mammon is there for a rich person, and therefore there's the temptation to worship that god, to put one's trust in that god, and to seek salvation from that god.
You mean seek my security from
it? Yeah, seek my security from it. Similarly, in marriage, because a legitimate part of marriage is to look out for the physical and material well-being of my children and my wife, to provide for them materially, that there's a temptation there to think that providing materially for them is what life is all about, that that's the most important thing, that's the only thing, and therefore I can get busy with the busyness of life. I can pursue the stuff of this world in a way, initially, legitimately so, because it's an act of love for my wife and my children on the one hand, but on the other hand, if I lose perspective on that, I just become a worldly person, and all of my values have become inverted. This world is more important to me than the life to come. The single person doesn't have that temptation quite as acutely as the married person does. They have a lot more freedom to just forsake the world, literally forsake the world. I think that's part of what Paul is talking about in 1 Corinthians 7 as well. So he acknowledges that there are very distinct advantages to being single. The freedom to pursue my calling without distraction, the freedom from this acute temptation that a married person faces. But he's not for a second. In fact, in the passage he explicitly denies that there's anything unspiritual or immoral about choosing to get married, even though he thinks it would be advisable to stay single. He says explicitly in the 28th verse, if you should marry, you have not sinned, he says. He says, I'm stating my preference. I enjoy my freedom so much that I would want you to have the freedom that I enjoy. But if you don't want that freedom, if you say, I really want to be married, you haven't done anything wrong. It's perfectly appropriate. And I think it's important to keep that perspective on 1 Corinthians 7, because otherwise we take his personal preference that he's stating for the freedom that he himself enjoys, that he's recommending to his readers, we take that as some kind of pronouncement of the spiritual superiority of singleness, and that is not what he's saying.
Okay, we're saying that singles don't have a spiritual superiority. Are they second-class citizens?
No, they are not that either. And that's more likely to be the attitude that modern people would take.
Yeah, in our culture today, I very much think it is. They're seen as second-class citizens, and often seen as second-class citizens, and often experience themselves in that way.
Yeah, and that's equally wrong. I know where the other attitude comes from. I'm not quite as sure where this attitude that we would somehow see single people as spiritually inferior would come from. Maybe you know better than I do. But that's certainly wrong. There's nothing in the New Testament that would justify us taking that attitude towards single people.
Well, I think some single people feel like there's something wrong with them if nobody wanted to marry them. So I have something inherently wrong with me, something wrong with my personality. I often hear single people questioning that, asking me directly, what's wrong with me? Why aren't men or women attracted to me? And it's a very, very difficult question for single people to grapple with. what's hard to explain to them is you could pick any married person. You could certainly pick myself and say, if I wasn't married, and say, well, Christine, you have these different personality traits. Sometimes you're real hard. Sometimes you're impatient. Sometimes you're pretty pushy. You talk too much. People could pick out those kinds of things and say, well, you know, maybe men just aren't attracted to that. But the fact is, a man was attracted to me despite all those personality flaws that I have. So it really doesn't have to do with personality flaws, because we're all sinners and we all have them.
Right.
In fact, what I've heard you say is when you get married, what you're doing is you're just deciding to live with a certain package of sinfulness.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I think it's very, very important for single people to understand how mysterious the decision to commit one's life to somebody else is. Did I commit my life to my wife 25 years ago because she was the best woman in the world? Well, no, not really. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I didn't do a contest and she won. There were other women in my life at that time that I greatly respected, that were mature, were godly, had genuine, authentic, profound faith. Why did I want to marry my wife and not them? It wasn't strictly on the merits of who she was as a person. It was much more mysterious than that. When it came right down to it, there was this subjective dimension that said, regardless of the merits of the people involved, this is the one I want to commit my life to. And I couldn't begin to analyze what lies behind, why would I commit myself to this person and not the next person? You can talk about the merits of this person and the merits of this person. They've both got merits. You can talk about the liabilities of this person and the liabilities of this person. They both have liabilities. How do you weigh merits and liabilities in a person? I don't know. But somehow, God, in providentially bringing people together, he plants that subjective willingness, that subjective desire to commit my life to that person. And it's a huge mistake for single people to think it's my liabilities that are the reason that I'm not married. That's not true. If I'm not married, it's not because of the liabilities that I have. I'm not married simply because God has not brought it to pass. So the one that I have to deal with is God in this thing, not other people and not myself. It's not a reflection on my worth as a person, on my merits as a person, on my strengths as a person. It's not a symptom of the fact that there's something wrong with me, that there's something deficient about me. Because if God doesn't want me married, all he has to do is not work that little mysterious magic that happens that makes somebody willing to commit their life to me. There are a lot of women in the world that I was not willing to marry, but it was not on the grounds that I found something wrong with them. It's that I just didn't want to marry them. And that's all. That's all that it meant.
Okay, so the question comes up, Jack, then why doesn't God give me someone to marry?
Well, that's what we addressed in part last week. Ultimately, it's locked in the mystery of his will and his purposes. For some reason, God has determined that part of my training in wisdom is going to be to be deprived of this need for marriage that God created me with, but to not give it to me, in order to face me into the suffering of that deprivation and allow that suffering to lead me into wisdom. And why that method? Why did he use that tool on me? I don't know. We have to ask God that question.
One of the points we made last week, though, is that God does bring suffering into all of our lives.
Yes.
He's bringing suffering in the form of singleness to single people. Sometimes he's bringing suffering in the form of marriage to marriage people. Yeah. To married people. There's just all sorts of ways that God brings suffering into our lives in order to train and to teach us. One thing that you said to me years ago that was profound and really made a difference in my life was, it isn't around suffering that God grows us, but it's in and through suffering that God grows us up. I want to continue with this a little bit more. Why does God not give me a marriage partner? And yes, we did address it some in our last week's program, but let's visit it again a little bit more. Is God punishing me?
No, that would not be a very helpful way to to think about it, it's the same issue with respect to all of my suffering. We may be tempted to think that I'm being deprived, I'm being made to suffer because God, in his wrath and his anger, is punishing me. But I don't think there's anything in the New Testament that ever invites us to think of it that way. Whenever the New Testament talks about suffering, it's always in the context of God training me, like a coach would train an athlete. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes he really stretches me. Sometimes he really pushes me to the limit of what I'm capable of. But he's not doing it because he hates me and he's out to destroy me. He's doing it because he's out to make me, to make me into a person qualified to enter into his kingdom one day. It's completely constructive in its intent and purpose, not destructive.
But the process of it is very difficult. When I was a child, I was on a swim team, and I remember my coach just really making us move. And I remember feeling nauseous, and I'd come to the end. He'd say, swim so many laps as fast as you can. I'd come to the end. I'd look at it, up at him like, gosh, you know, I finally made it. I'm at the end. And he'd say, no, go. 10 more laps. And I felt like I could hardly do it. I was just going to drown. But what he was trying to do was make an athlete of me. The process of making an athlete out of me was to suffer. Was there a goal? Absolutely. I loved getting those ribbons when we went to those right. those meets. But the process of getting there was extremely difficult.
Yeah.
And laborious.
And that imagery, I mean, that is used a lot in the New Testament. It's the athlete who's going to run the race, but he needs to train if he's going to win the race. But when he wins the race, there's a crown, a reward, a victory on the other end of that race for being the winner. That's exactly how our odyssey in this life, the process of sanctification that we have to go through in this life, is viewed as an athlete training to run that race and win it.
Okay, so Jack, I have this one other point that I want to bring up before the end of our time. I think we have time for it, and let me see if I can articulate it. Okay, so what I've got to do is I've got to understand that God has not given me this state of... He hasn't given me marriage. He's given me singleness. So what I've got to do is come to a place where I accept that. And I really say, okay, God, I'll hold on to that and that'll be okay. And then, once I do that, God will give it to me because I've done the good thing. I've accepted what he's given me.
Yeah, we will sometimes use... We grasp for ways to manipulate God, to get God to give us what we really want. What we need to do instead is to submit to what God is going to do in my life, not try to manipulate God into giving me what I want. But that's exactly the psychology that we use sometimes, is that we're thinking, if I can just bring myself to the state of resignation to the will of God, where I really don't care anymore whether he gives it to me, then he will give it to me. There's another kind of psychological trick that we use on ourselves as well. We don't give ourselves the freedom to allow my desire for marriage to wane, to go away, to diminish. We need to keep it active and alive and vigorous, because our thought process is, if I ever become content not being married, then God will think that I don't really care anymore, and then for sure he won't give me a marriage
partner.
Exactly,
yeah.
And I think that's wrong too. I mean, we just need to let our desire wax and wane as it just naturally does. And if I get to a point where I'm just thoroughly content not being married, that's no obstacle. If God wants me married, he's going to make me married whether I want it or not. My contentment is no incentive for God to decide not to give it to me.
Well, I think you hit it right on. You didn't mince any words. You said that both of these things, these ways of approaching God, are manipulation. And I agree with you. I think it's exactly that. But oftentimes that's the way we think. If I just get to a certain place, then this will happen or that will happen. It seems ridiculous as we're talking about it right now, but there's a lot of people out there who are pretty desperate about being married, and they want to work it in whatever way they can so that somehow they will get to be married.
Yeah. And that's the key, is that ultimately the thing that we need to face into, the thing we need to ask, is who ultimately is going to dictate what I have out of life and what I experience here in life. Am I willing to let God be the Lord of my life, the shape that it takes to define it, to fashion it in a way that he wants to, or am I going to insist that he fashion it in a way that is acceptable to me. And I can't, I've got to make, that's a fundamental choice that every human being has to make. The child of God has to ultimately decide that God is my Lord. He's my creator. He's the author of my being and the author of my life. And he has every right and all the authority to fashion it in the way that he deems best. And my job is to simply let him do that. The alternative is to rebel against that and say, no, he has no right. It's my life. I ought to be able to define it the way I want to define it. But that is a heart of unbelief and rebellion that ultimately is a heart that's damnable. I dare not go there.
And that rebellion can be very quiet. It doesn't have to necessarily be an angry, harsh statement that
right.
I make verbally.
Right.
It just could come through the kind of subtle, quiet manipulation that we just talked about.
Right. But it's rebellion nonetheless.
It's rebellion nonetheless. But we get really sidetracked by the way things look. If we look passive, if we look compliant, if we look pious, then we think we're not being rebellious. But all of us need to look at, are we accepting from the hand of God what he's giving us, or are we not? We talked about that a lot in our series on marriage, how we can be accepting the husband or wife that God gave us, or are we setting out to change them, to make them who we want them to be? So as single people or as married people, we can be rebelliously going up against what God has given us and not accepting what God has fashioned in our life. We don't have to be in any particular state to do that. It seems to me we need to assume that we are doing that in a lot of our lives, in lots of parts of our lives, and try and look at how we are accepting what God's given us, or how we're not accepting it, how we're trying to fashion our lives in such a way that we're having it the way we want it and not having to go through the suffering that God might be designing for us.
And if we believe what the Bible teaches us, if we believe the New Testament, it teaches us that this is what you're saying, it teaches us that we are innately, inherently evil people. Rebellion comes very naturally to us, so it shouldn't surprise us if an objective analysis of our own behavior reveals to us this rebellion, this resistance to God, this resistance to allow him to be the Lord. That comes very naturally to us, and we should be ready and willing to admit it and confess it when we see it in our life.
So if I'm a single person who's listening today and I find that I'm a person who's been trying to manipulate God by being uninterested in marriage now, and is that then an indication that I'm not a believer? Is that, am I in big trouble because of that?
No, not necessarily. Because it just depends on how we respond to the realization that I've been rebellious. If we realize, yeah, this is really a pocket of rebellion in me, and I go, God, save me from this. God, change my heart. Don't let me be this way. The fact that I even want to be delivered from my own rebellion is, I think, an indication that I really am a child of God, chosen by him. But if I just somehow find a way of either rationalizing my rebellion and denying it, or entrench myself all the more deeply in my rebellion, then yes, that's very dangerous. If I can stay there, it can only be because I'm a damnable child of the devil.
Some people ask the question, what is Mackenzie Study Center? Well, Mackenzie has been described as a Christian think tank, as a group of mavericks answerable only to themselves, as a breath of fresh air in a room of stodgy religiosity, and described as a forum from which the tough issues of life and theology are reasonably addressed. Let me try to describe Mackenzie in this way. Mackenzie Study Center is a 13,000-square-foot former fraternity house located within a block and a half of the University of Oregon. Mackenzie has 5 full-time staff researchers and teachers, plus several part-time instructors. Mackenzie is 20 to 25 people living at the study center while working in the community, studying at the university, or with the Mackenzie staff. Mackenzie Study Center is the papers, seminars, and conferences that challenge the way we often do Christianity. And Mackenzie is this weekly radio program, Christianity at Work. And though their conclusions regarding biblical and social issues may differ from yours and mine, you need never question the Mackenzie staff's willingness to bow to the authority of the Scriptures. Would you like to know more? Call the Study Center. Ask to be placed on a mailing list that will assure you receive the monthly News and Views. It's free and it's informative. Call area code 541-485-4801. That's area code 541-485-4801. Let's get back to Christianity at Work.
In this program, as well as the last one, we were asking ourselves the question, how should I look at myself as a single person? Or how should I look at singleness? Is it a curse? Last week we said, absolutely no, it's not a curse. In fact, we said this week that God has given singleness as a gift to some people. Is it a gift in the sense that some people just don't feel the need to be married? We said, no, that's not what the gift is. But singleness is a gift in the sense that it allows me the time, it allows me the freedom to pursue my calling as a Christian, unencumbered by some of the things that a married person is encumbered by. Time spent with their spouse, time spent with their children, time spent trying to make a living for their family. Those kinds of things are not things that encumber a single person. And it's only in that respect that singleness is a gift.
And additionally, I would add that I think this is biblical. Maybe I'm making this up, but I think it's additionally a gift in that it really is can potentially be a less tempting condition or state, just as the poor person is not tempted to make material possessions of God to quite the same degree that a wealthy person is. A single person is not tempted to invest their time and energy and priorities in this world to the same degree that a married person might be, because rightly they are taking care of the material and worldly needs of their wife or children.
On the other hand, it isn't a given that a single person will pursue the things of God. Okay. Possibly we said that a single person, and perhaps often single people, pursue just this whole total focus of looking for a spouse, looking for someone to be married to, looking for a life of connectedness in that way, focusing on their deprivation primarily and only.
And then we went on to talk about how being a single person is neither a super spiritual, super saintly kind of state, that it's not a morally and spiritually superior condition, but neither is it a second class status either. And we're probably more tempted in the modern world to think the latter. It's important to realize that being single and being married are just simply different callings that God gives us. And it's completely inappropriate to place some kind of value judgment on which calling is more spiritual or more moral than the other. They're equally viable options.
We concluded by saying that being married is a gift of God. It doesn't have to do with whether or not we are sinners, whether or not we have physical or emotional or social handicaps. All of us have spiritual, emotional, and social handicaps. That's not the reason we're married or not. The reason we're married or the reason we're single is because God decided that it would be so.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center. Thank you for listening.